When we normally think about like a regime change or a government being overthrown, we tend to picture something right out of a history textbook. Like we picture this dramatic, unmistakable revolution. There are tanks rolling down the streets, a new flag being run up the flagpole, maybe a constitution being publicly torn up and replaced with this brand new document.
Exactly. It's a loud, visible, undeniable rupture in the timeline. It's an event you can point to and say, okay, the old system is definitively gone, and the new system has just aggressively announced its arrival.
But then you step into the world of American constitutional law and administrative structure, and you encounter this completely different theory of transformation. I mean, what if the regime change already happened, but it's just completely silent? Think about it like this for a second. Imagine you walk into your childhood home. The paint on the outside is exactly the same shade of blue. The front door has the same brass knocker. You walk inside. The furniture in the living room is exactly where you left it. The family photos are still hanging on the wall. But as you live in the house for a few days, you start noticing strange things.
Things feel off.
Exactly. And you slowly realize that over the years, someone came in and completely replaced the foundation. I mean, they ripped out the plumbing and the electrical wiring while you were sleeping, and they replaced it with a foreign system that operates on completely different principles. You are still living in the house. It looks like your house. But the structure keeping it standing is fundamentally entirely different.
It's the absolute definition of a structural illusion. You are looking at a familiar shell, but the operating system running beneath it has been entirely swapped out. And because the paint hasn't changed, the inhabitants don't even realize they're living under a new architecture.
And that concept brings us to exactly what we are tackling today. So welcome to our deep dive into a profound structural question about the American government. Today, we're exploring a quiet transformation. We are looking at a gradual, almost invisible shift in how power actually operates on a day-to-day basis.
And our source material for this exploration is a, well, it's a highly analytical, structurally staggering law review article from April 2026.
Yeah, it's a dense one.
Very dense. It was published in the Government Accountability Commission Law Review. The title is The Administrative State and the Quiet Supersession of the Constitution, written by a constitutional scholar using the pen name Publius Custos.
So we're going to decode this complex legal philosophy today. Our mission is to really understand this author's central argument, which is that the modern administrative state hasn't just expanded the government as we know it. It has actually replaced the Constitution's operating system while keeping its outer shell perfectly intact. Now, what makes Custos's piece so compelling is that it completely sidesteps the usual partisan shouting match, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And because this source material tackles, concepts regarding government power, regulation, and how the Constitution should be interpreted, I want to be crystal clear right up front. Neither of us is taking a political side today.
No sides.
We aren't here to argue left-wing policy or right-wing policy. Our goal is strictly impartial. We're just going to rip off the floorboards and show you the architectural blueprint the author has drawn up, just so you can see how these structural arguments fit together.
We are essentially acting as your guides through the architecture of the argument itself. It's a structural analysis, and we're just going to evaluate it on its structural merits.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because Custis starts by setting up a premise that changes how you view every single interaction you have with the government today.
Yeah, literally every interaction.
From getting a simple driver's license to paying your taxes to applying for a permit to build a deck on the back of your house. The text argues that in all of these interactions, you are operating under a completely different set of rules than the ones the founders originally designed. I mean, we still have courts, we still have legislatures, we still hold elections every 2 and 4 years. The facade of the republic is entirely intact.
But the author is very precise here. The claim is that American law didn't disappear, right? Its forms were simply retained while its operative structure was materially altered. So the courts and legislatures still exist, but they function under completely different assumptions concerning their authority and their jurisdiction than they did under the original common law system. And to really grasp this, Custis introduces a concept called the binary anchor.
Law versus fiat. Yeah, I read this section a few times because it's so foundational. The author says there is no middle ground here, right?
Custis argues that every legal system in human history rests on a single, unavoidable antecedent premise. It's a binary choice. Either law precedes government.
Meaning law exists first and it binds the government.
Exactly. Or government precedes law, meaning the government exists first and it creates and defines the law. Custis argues you cannot blend these two. Either law is prior to power and restrains it, or power is prior to law and merely uses law as a tool to express its will.
And under the common law system that the founders inherited from England and, you know, built a constitution upon, they very clearly chose the first option.
Right. Law precedes the government.
The government is born into a pre-existing web of legal restraints. Mm. And this brings us to a really fascinating practical application, which is the burden of proof. Under this old system, there was a strict rule. The text translates it as, he who asserts must prove.
Yes. The legal maxim dictates that the burden of proof lies upon the party asserting authority, not upon the party denying it. You cannot be required to prove a negative. And this wasn't just some procedural preference in an 18th century courtroom, you know. Custis stresses that this is a foundational rule of human reason. And crucially, it applies to the state just as much as it applies to two neighbors arguing over a property line.
Let's visualize that, actually. Mm. If I tell my neighbor, hey, you can't build your fence there, that's my land, I can't just make the claim and force my neighbor to prove me wrong.
Right, you can't just say it and walk away.
Yeah, I have to pull out my property deed, I have to show the surveyor's map, I have to prove my title to the land. I am asserting a right to restrict my neighbor. So I bear 100% of the burden of proof.
That's a perfect analogy. Now, apply that to the state. If the government wants to restrict your life, your liberty, or your property, the burden is entirely on the state.
They have to prove it.
Exactly. They have to trace their lawful authority to do so. They must identify the exact source of their power, trace the chain of how that power was lawfully delegated to them, and prove that their specific action falls within their lawful jurisdiction.
And if they can't?
If they cannot meet that strict burden of proof, then they aren't exercising power under law. They're just assuming power by office.
But wait, let me push back on this a little bit, because looking at the reality of how things work today, doesn't the modern state just say they have the authority because they are, in fact, the government?
Right.
Like, if an environmental agency or a tax board issues a rule, they issue it under the authority of being the state. They have the official seal. They have the massive headquarters in Washington. They have the enforcement agents. Doesn't their sheer existence imply their authority?
And you've just articulated exactly the shift that Custis is trying to expose.
Wait, really?
Yes. The author argues that the modern administrative state does exactly what you just described. It presumes its own authority based merely on its institutional existence. It operates by fiat.
Okay, wow.
It assumes that because it exists as a government agency tasked with some general mission, it has the inherent power to act however it deems necessary to achieve that mission. And Putley's Custis argues that this presumption completely collapses the distinction between lawful rule and arbitrary power.
I see.
If authority becomes self-ratifying, if delegation is just presumed because an agency has a seal in a building, then the law isn't binding power anymore. Law just becomes the language that power uses to justify whatever it already decided to do.
So if the government isn't automatically the state with all these inherent powers just because it exists, then who or what actually is the state?
That is the million-dollar question.
And it brings us to a point in the text that fundamentally redefines the vocabulary we use. Custis insists that modern public law constantly confuses the state with the government. And, I mean, we all do this, right?
Oh, absolutely.
We use the terms interchangeably in everyday conversation.
We do, but Custis argues it's a massive conceptual error. Properly understood within American constitutional law, the state is not the government. The state is the people, acting in their sovereign capacity. The government is merely the temporary mechanical instrument that the state, meaning the people, creates and uses to execute its will.
And the author doesn't just offer this as some abstract philosophical idea either.
Mm-hmm.
Custis brings historical receipts. This distinction is written directly into the early state constitutions.
The textual evidence is incredibly specific here. Look at the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780, which John Adams drafted and which served as a massive influence on the federal constitution.
Right.
It explicitly states that all magistrates and officers of government are but substitutes and agents of the people. Maryland's constitution calls them trustees of the public.
Oh, wow.
And Custis points out that states across the country, from Alaska to Alabama, retain materially identical language to this day. Power is inherent in the people. Government is a derivative instrument. Officers are fiduciaries.
Let's focus on those specific words for a second. Substitutes, agents, trustees. That isn't majestic language about rulers and subjects. That is literally the language of agency law. It implies a very strict legal and contractual relationship.
Exactly. It defines the legal character of the office itself. If the government is legally defined as an agent or a trustee, it has zero inherent sovereignty. It has absolutely no independent prerogative to just make things up as it goes.
Right.
It only possesses the specific enumerated powers that have been delegated to it by the principal, which is the people.
The article actually cites a few landmark Supreme Court cases to prove how this used to operate in practice. Yickwo v. Hopkins and Ex parte Young.
Right.
I want to make sure we don't just gloss over these because they seem really critical to the author's point. What actually happened in these cases?
Let's start with Yickwo v. Hopkins from 1886. San Francisco passed an ordinance saying you needed a special permit to operate a laundry in a wooden building. On its face, it looked like a basic safety regulation.
Makes sense.
But the board granted permits to virtually all white applicants and denied them to virtually all Chinese applicants.
Wow.
Right. So the Supreme Court struck it down, and the core reasoning was profound. The court said that in the American system, sovereignty remains with the people, leaving no room for government officials to exercise purely arbitrary power.
Right.
The board couldn't just say, well, we have the authority to decide who gets a permit. Their power was derivative and bounded by the rights of the people.
And what about Ex parte Young?
Ex parte Young in 1908 takes this concept of agency to its logical conclusion. It establishes that when a government officer acts unconstitutionally, when they step outside the bounds of the power delegated to them, they are literally stripped of their official character.
Wait, really?
Yes. Yeah. They are no longer legally acting as the state. They become just a regular private person committing an offense, and they are subject to personal legal consequences.
Which sets up what Custis calls the firewall of law. This is the ultimate checkpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Before the government can command you to do something, or restrain your liberty, or punish you financially, it has to be able to answer a very strict sequence of questions. By what lawful authority are you acting? Derived from whom? For what end? And within what jurisdiction?
It's the enforcement mechanism of these constitutional first principles. Power is never self-authenticating. It must show its title. Command must show its warrant.
Right.
If any link in that chain of authority is missing, the government's action fails at the threshold. It's exposed as mere force masquerading under the color of law.
Let me build on an analogy we used a bit earlier to really ground this, because I think the concept of principal and agent can sound a bit dry.
Sure.
Let's think of the government as a babysitter. The babysitter doesn't own the house. When the parents who represent the people, the ultimate sovereign, hire the babysitter, they give very specific delegated instructions. You know, you can give the kids dinner at 6, they can watch 1 hour of TV, and they need to be in bed by 8.
Right. That is the delegated authority.
Now, let's say the babysitter decides that it would be way more efficient to just lock the kids in their bedrooms at 5 o'clock so the babysitter can watch a movie in peace.
Right. Terrible babysitter.
Exactly. And if the parents come home and ask what happened, the babysitter can't just say, well, I'm the babysitter. I have the inherent authority to manage the household however I see fit for the sake of efficiency.
Right.
The parents would immediately say, show me exactly where on the instruction sheet I gave you permission to lock my kids in a room. That is the firewall of law. It's the principal demanding that the agent prove their specific delegated authority.
That maps the structural relationship Custis is describing perfectly. The babysitter is the agent. The authority is strictly bounded. If the babysitter exceeds that authority, they aren't acting as a babysitter anymore. They're acting as an intruder.
Wow, yeah.
And what Custis is arguing is that the modern administrative state operates like a babysitter who has slowly, over decades, convinced the household that they actually own the house and that the parents are just guests who need to ask permission to use the kitchen.
Which is a terrifying thought. And if the people are the ultimate sovereign and the government is just the babysitter, what happens to the inherent rights of the people when this administrative state grows and starts taking over the house?
It's a huge problem.
Because this leads us to the next massive shift Custis identifies. The alchemy of administration. How our fundamental rights are treated.
To understand the severity of this shift, we really have to understand the constitutional baseline. Custis points out that under the original order, rights precede the state.
Okay.
The Constitution does not create your liberty. It presupposes it. It recognizes pre-existing claims that belong to you simply because you are human.
Right. The author quotes the Wisconsin and Virginia state constitutions here. They explicitly say that governments are instituted to secure pre-existing inherent rights. The rights exist in nature first. The government is created second, solely to protect what already exists.
Precisely. And this leads to another ancient legal maxim that Custos leans on, which is ubi jus, ibi remedium. Where there is a right, there must be a remedy.
Let's break that down. What does that actually mean in practice?
It means that a right isn't just a philosophical idea. It is an actionable legal claim. If you have a right and the government violates it, you must have a direct, accessible legal remedy to stop them and hold them accountable.
Right.
Custos argues that this is the operational condition that separates a society of law from a society of force. If a legal system allows rights to be violated but provides no practical remedy for the citizen, it doesn't actually secure rights at all. It just decorates its legal codes with the word rights to sound legitimate.
It's just window dressing.
Exactly. And Custos argues that the administrative state kills rights not by repealing them, but by destroying the remedy.
Wow.
Yeah, they introduce concepts like administrative exhaustion or absolute immunity for government officers. And once the remedy is out of reach, the right is effectively dead.
You know, I really want to pause and define administrative exhaustion because the text mentions it as a primary weapon of the administrative state. But a lot of listeners might not know how it works in the real world. How does a citizen actually get trapped in administrative exhaustion?
Let's walk through a hypothetical that happens all the time. Say you own a piece of property and you want to build a small pond. An environmental agency steps in and says, no, we've determined your property is a protected wetland you can't build.
Okay.
You look at the law and you firmly believe the agency has zero jurisdiction over your land. You believe they are violating your constitutional property rights.
Right.
Under a common law system, you would go straight to a neutral judge, assert your right, and force the agency to prove their jurisdiction.
But under the administrative state?
Under the administrative state, the judge will tell you, I can't hear your case yet. You haven't exhausted your administrative remedies. This means you are legally forced to go through the agency's own internal dispute process first. You have to appeal to the agency's internal hearing officer. When they rule against you, you have to appeal to the agency's internal review board.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you have to hire specialized lawyers, pay administrative fees, and wait months or years for each decision. You are trapped in a bureaucratic loop entirely controlled by the very agency you are accusing of overreach.
That is wild.
And only after you have spent a fortune and years of your life exhausting every internal process, maybe you are allowed to ask a real constitutional court to look at it. Custos argues that the process itself becomes the punishment. The deprivation of your right is complete the moment lawful, immediate redress is withheld.
That is incredibly frustrating just to listen to. But here's where it gets even more insidious.
Yeah.
Because the administrative state doesn't usually just come out and say, we are repealing your right to free speech, or we are repealing your right to property.
Right, they wouldn't do that.
That would be too obvious. That would spark a massive public backlash. Instead, Custos argues, the state destroys rights by converting them into regulated privileges.
This is the exact alchemy the title of the section refers to. A right that is antecedent to the state cannot become a privilege granted by the state without fundamentally changing its legal DNA. A right exists prior to permission. A privilege exists only by grant.
Let's visualize this conversion. Imagine you have the natural right to speak your mind. You can just walk outside, stand on a soapbox, and talk. That is a right.
Yep.
But then the state comes along and says, oh, you still have the right to speak. Absolutely. We love free speech.
Yeah.
But to ensure public order, you just need to fill out Form 8B, pay a $75 processing fee, wait 6 to 8 weeks for a background check, and obtain a speech license from the Department of Vocalization.
Right, right. And once that happens, what is the reality of your situation?
The reality is that the right still technically exists on paper, but practically, it functions entirely by permission. You are no longer acting as a free person exercising a right. You are a licensee operating under a state-granted privilege.
That is the exact mechanism of conversion. The state acknowledges the right in principle, but then conditions its actual exercise through procedural qualification administered by institutional gatekeepers.
Wow.
And those gatekeepers acquire discretionary authority to approve, deny, or suspend the exercise of what was once a fundamental right. Custos points to two Supreme Court cases that tried to stop this exact phenomenon. Murdoch v. Pennsylvania in 1943 and Shuttlesworth v. City of Birmingham in 1969.
What were the specifics of those cases?
In Murdoch, a city tried to impose a licensing fee on Jehovah's Witnesses who were going door to door distributing religious literature. The Supreme Court struck it down, explicitly stating that a state may not impose a charge for the enjoyment of a right granted by the federal constitution.
Okay, that makes sense. And Shuttlesworth.
In Shuttlesworth, civil rights marchers were arrested for parading without a permit. But the city's permit ordinance gave city commissioners massive, unguided discretion to deny permits based on, well, public welfare.
Oh, wow, that's broad.
Very broad. The court struck that down too, warning that if you have to ask for permission and that permission can be denied based on broad, subjective, discretionary standards, you don't have a right anymore. You have a revocable indulgence of the state.
But despite those Supreme Court warnings, Custis is arguing that this conversion from rights to privileges has become the standard operating procedure for the entire administrative state.
Yes, it really has. And once rights are downgraded into permissions, the state has to fundamentally change how it views the actual human being exercising them. Which brings us to the reclassification of the citizen.
Right. Because if rights belong to free persons, but privileges are managed through status, the system must redefine what you are. Custis calls this the administrative reclassification of the person. The state stops viewing you as a constitutional person endowed with inherent rights. Instead, it starts mediating your entire existence through administrative statuses. You become a licensee, a taxpayer, a registrant, an applicant, a dependent, a regulated subject.
And we really need to emphasize why this change of vocabulary is so dangerous structurally. Conditions attach to statuses, not to persons.
Okay.
A free person doesn't need to justify their freedom, but a licensee must constantly justify their compliance to keep their license active.
So if you are reclassified into one of these administrable statuses, the state doesn't look like it's restraining your fundamental liberty. It just looks like it is managing the conditions attached to your regulated role.
Exactly. You are no longer a principal confronting an agent. You are a managed subject confronting a manager.
Which leads to what might be the most devastatingly effective part of this whole quiet takeover. The inversion of the burden of proof. It completely flips from what we talked about at the beginning.
It does. I mean, we established earlier that under the original Constitution, the burden of proof is heavily on the government. The state has to prove exactly why it has the authority to restrict you. You are presumed free.
Right.
But under the administrative state, once you are pushed into a licensed status, the burden completely shifts to you. You have to prove that you are compliant in order to be allowed to live your life.
Wow.
You have to prove your entitlement to work, your entitlement to travel, your entitlement to build on your own property. Freedom is no longer a presumption. It is a status that must be constantly demonstrated and proven within the state's administrative terms.
So you are basically presumed guilty, or at least presumed non-compliant until you prove otherwise.
In a structural sense, absolutely. And Custis argues that this inversion completely destroys the traditional concept of due process.
Okay, let me stop you there because a listener might be thinking, wait a minute, we still have due process today. If an administrative agency fines me or denies my business permit, I can demand a hearing. There are administrative law judges, there are appeals processes, people get hearings all the time. Isn't that due process?
Custis would argue that what you just described is the illusion of continuity. It looks like a legal process, so we call it due process, but structurally, it is fundamentally different. Custis dives deep into the historical definition of due process, dating back to Magna Carta and the common law. Historically, due process was a strict condition precedent.
A condition precedent, meaning a sequence of events that absolutely must happen before the state is allowed to lay a finger on your life, liberty, or property.
Precisely. It was a strict, unyielding sequence. First, there had to be an actual injury or a violation of a known law. Second, there had to be a sworn accusation by an injured party or an official under oath. Third, a neutral, independent magistrate had to review that charge to see if there was probable cause. Fourth, a lawful, specific charge was issued. Fifth, you were given a hearing before a lawful tribunal, often a jury of your peers, where the burden of proof remained entirely on the accuser.
Right.
And only after all of that happened and a lawful judgment was handed down could any punishment or deprivation follow. Every step was a condition precedent to the next step. Force follows law.
But the administrative state scrambles that entire sequence.
It completely upends it. Custis argues that modern administrative due process is mostly a post-deprivation trap. Think about how agencies often operate. They can investigate you without necessarily having a specific injured party. They can issue a notice of violation without a sworn oath.
Wow.
And crucially, they can take action like suspending your professional license or freezing your assets or shutting down your business operations before any neutral judge ever reviews the case.
So the penalty is imposed first.
Yes. The deprivation happens at the beginning of the process, not the end. And that hearing you mentioned earlier, the administrative hearing,
yeah,
that is just a post hoc procedure happening after the deprivation has already occurred, where the burden is now on you to prove that the agency made a mistake. It is due process completely reordered, which Custis argues means it is due process completely denied.
He gets backwards.
Exactly. Process without lawful restraint beforehand is just administration. It is not due process.
Let's use a real-world example to make this concrete. Imagine the state suspects you owe them more taxes.
Sure.
Under the historical model, they would have to take you to a neutral court, present their evidence, prove to a jury that you committed tax evasion, get a judgment, and then finally they could garnish your wages.
Right. The deprivation comes last.
But today, a tax agency can just decide you owe them money, issue a lien, and immediately freeze your bank account. You wake up, your money is inaccessible, the deprivation happens on day one.
Mm-hmm.
If you want your money back, you have to navigate their administrative appeals process to prove to them that they were wrong. You bear the burden of proving your innocence to get your property back.
That is the exact inversion Custis is warning about, and it raises a massive structural red flag. Because if the state, or more specifically, a single administrative agency is acting as the investigator, the accuser, and the judge all at the same time, while skipping the traditional sequence of due process, how does that possibly square with the constitutional rule of separated powers?
Right, because the founders were absolutely obsessed with checks and balances.
Completely obsessed.
And according to the text, it doesn't square at all. It obliterates it. This brings us to the collapse of enumerated power and the rise of what Custis calls the administrative combination. And it all starts the broken chain of delegation. We have another great Latin maxim from the text here. Delegata potestas non potest delegari. A delegate cannot delegate.
This is a foundational, non-negotiable rule of agency law. Let's go back to our examples. If I give you a power of attorney to sell my car because I'm out of the country, I am delegating a specific power to you.
Right.
You cannot just take that power of attorney, cross your name out, write your cousin's name in, and hand the power over to him without my permission.
Yeah, I definitely couldn't do that.
The power was delegated specifically to you by me, and it legally stops with you. Custis applies this exact logic to the Constitution. The people, the ultimate sovereign, delegated legislative power specifically to the Congress. Therefore, Congress cannot just turn around and hand that legislative power to an unelected administrative agency.
But I'm going to push back again, because a critic of Custis would say, look at the modern world. How can Congress possibly manage a modern electrical grid, or regulate commercial aviation safety, or oversee complex financial derivatives?
Right, it's too much.
They have to delegate that power to experts. If they didn't, the modern state would grind to a halt.
And Custis addresses that directly. The argument is not that society isn't complex. The argument is that complexity doesn't grant you a magic wand to bypass the structural rules of the Constitution.
Okay.
If society needs a new type of flexible managerial power that the Constitution doesn't currently allow, the lawful solution is to amend the Constitution to create that power. What you cannot do is pretend the original document allows you to build an extra constitutional managerial state.
That is exactly what Congress does.
Yes. They pass a broad, vague law saying ensure clean air or maintain safe workplaces, and they hand a blank check to an agency to figure out what that actually means, write the specific rules, and enforce them.
And Custis argues this is structurally fatal to the Republic.
It is. The administrative state treats constitutional delegation as a transferable asset. Power cascades down from Congress to the heads of agencies, then to sub-agencies, then to internal regulatory boards, and finally to regional hearing officers. By the time a specific rule is enforced against a citizen, the bureaucrat imposing the fine is so far removed from the original constitutional grant of power, the elected Congress, that the chain of lawful title is completely broken.
And it doesn't stop there. Custis notes how agencies continually expand what they are allowed to govern through a process called jurisdiction by accretion. They don't stay in their lane, they just keep widening the highway based on what they claim is administrative necessity.
Exactly. Subject matter jurisdiction is supposed to be rigidly fixed by the nature of the legal grant. If you are given authority over navigable rivers, you can only regulate navigable rivers.
Right.
But administrative agencies continually redefine the scope of their own jurisdiction over time. If they decide they need to regulate a seasonal puddle in a farmer's field in order to properly manage a river 50 miles away, they will claim jurisdiction over the puddle.
Unbelievable.
They expand by internal interpretation, by writing their own rules, or by vaguely asserting the public interest. But Custis writes that jurisdiction cannot be enlarged by usage or implied by convenience. What was never explicitly delegated never magically ripens into lawful title just because it's convenient.
Which brings us to the core danger, what we might call the unholy trinity, the combination of powers. You mentioned the Massachusetts Constitution earlier, and Custis brings it up again here because it contains the clearest, most explicit warning about this specific danger.
The Massachusetts Constitution of 1780 states plainly that the legislative department shall never exercise the executive or judicial powers, the executive shall never exercise the legislative or judicial powers, and the judicial shall never exercise the legislative or executive powers.
It's very clear.
And it gives the exact reason why. To the end, it may be a government of laws and not of men. Consolidating those three powers into one set of hands was seen by the founding generation as the very definition of arbitrary tyrannical rule.
Let me use an analogy to picture this administrative combination in the modern era.
Yeah.
Imagine if your local Department of Transportation operated like a federal administrative agency.
Yeah.
The DOT decides what the speed limit should be on every road, and they write those rules down. That is a legislative act. Then the DOT hires its own specialized traffic cops with radar guns to patrol the roads and pull you over for breaking the rules they just wrote.
Yeah.
That is an executive act.
Right.
And then when you want to fight the ticket, you aren't allowed to go to the municipal courthouse. You have to appeal the ticket in a special traffic dispute center that is funded, staffed, and run by the exact same Department of Transportation. The judge works for the DOT. That is a judicial act.
That is a perfect, contained illustration of the structural defect Custis is pointing out. It is a completely closed loop. Administrative agencies promulgate rules of general applicability. They legislate. They investigate and enforce those rules using their own personnel they execute. And they adjudicate alleged violations through their own internal tribunals they judge. They hold all three powers in the same hand. And Custis is very quick to point out that calling these functions quasi-legislative or quasi-judicial doesn't cure the constitutional defect. As the author notes, prefixes do not restore separation.
Right. And we need to make sure listeners understand the stakes here. We aren't just talking about getting a warning letter or a small traffic ticket. Custis issues a massive warning about the power of administrative punishment. Because the power to punish is the sharpest, most dangerous edge of sovereign force.
Historically, punishment, whether it was taking away someone's property, leveling massive financial fines, or revoking their livelihood, was subject to the absolute strictest constitutional restraints. You needed an independent jury of your peers. You needed an independent Article III court.
Let's define an Article III court really quickly for those who might need a refresher.
Sure. Article 3 of the Constitution establishes the independent judicial branch. Article 3 judges are nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate. Crucially, they have lifetime tenure and salary protection. That means they cannot be fired and their pay cannot be cut if they rule against the government. They are completely insulated from political or bureaucratic pressure. Administrative law judges, on the other hand, are employees of the executive branch agencies. They do not have Article III protections.
Right. So historically, to punish someone, the state had to go through an independent Article III judge and a jury. But Custis points out that the administrative state bypasses juries and constitutional courts entirely by playing a very clever word game.
They do. They bypass the constitutional requirements by simply changing the label of the punishment. They call these massive fines and license revocations civil penalties or regulatory sanctions or collateral administrative disabilities.
Wow.
By legally classifying the punishment as civil or regulatory rather than criminal, they argue they don't need a jury and they don't need an Article III court. They detach the punishment from the constitutional restraints that were specifically designed to confine it.
That's sneaky.
It is. But Custis argues forcefully that a fine that bankrupts a family is a punishment, and the deprivation of a professional license that ruins a career is a punishment, regardless of what soothing bureaucratic label the agency slaps on it.
So if you're a listener following all this, a very natural burning question arises right about now. If this system violates the fundamental design of the Constitution so blatantly, if it breaks the separation of powers, if it destroys strict due process, if it turns inherent rights into regulated privileges, and if it bypasses independent courts to issue punishments,
yeah.
Why do the courts let it happen?
Right.
Like, why didn't the Supreme Court just look at this 70 years ago and strike the whole thing down?
That is the multi-trillion-dollar question at the heart of modern American law. And Custos answers it by detailing a phenomenon called circularity and institutional self-ratification. The author calls this the gravest intellectual scandal in the modern American legal order. It is essentially a bureaucratic magic trick that creates legitimacy out of thin air.
Explain the circularity. How does the semantic fraud of settled law actually work in practice? Walk me through the timeline of how an agency gets away with this.
It operates as a sequence of institutional reinforcement that spans decades. Let's walk through it step by step. Step one, an administrative agency decides it needs to tackle a new problem, so it assumes a new regulatory power that has no clear, explicit constitutional or statutory title. They just write a rule and start enforcing it.
Okay, so the usurpation begins. What happens next?
Step two. The agency exercises this newly invented power for 5, 10, maybe 15 years. It becomes an ordinary, everyday practice. Businesses adapt to it. Forms are printed. The bureaucracy hums along.
But eventually, someone gets fed up and sues them.
Right, exactly. Step three. A citizen finally challenges the agency's power in a federal court. But by this time, the court looks at the landscape and says, well, the agency has been doing this for 15 years. Entire industries rely on this regulatory framework now. It would cause massive disruption to strike it down. Therefore, we should defer to the agency's long-standing practice and expertise. The court upholds the rule, not because it was originally lawful, but because it is now entrenched.
Wow. Okay, so the court blesses it purely based on longevity.
Right. Then we move to step four. The legislature, Congress, looks at the court ruling and says, well, the federal courts just upheld this agency's power, so it must be completely legal. So Congress continues to fund the agency and maybe even expands its budget to enforce the rule.
And the loop closes.
Step five completes the circle. The agency, if ever questioned again, points to the court's deference and the legislature's continued funding as absolute, undeniable proof that their power was entirely legitimate from the very beginning.
I see exactly what Custis means by circularity. The power never actually had a lawful origin. Nobody ever proved the constitutional delegation at the very beginning. The agency just assumed it, and because it survived long enough without being stopped, it eventually got labeled as precedent, and an usurpation made self-ratifying.
Precisely. Custis uses a brilliant phrase to summarize this fraud. Repetition is not delegation. Usage is not title. Just because an institution recognizes a power and uses it repeatedly does not mean the Constitution actually granted it.
Right.
But in the modern system, mere continuity is treated as legitimacy. Once that circularity locks in, unconstitutional power becomes self-sustaining. Each unconstitutional act becomes the foundational precedent for the next one.
This describes the how of the quiet regime change perfectly. But it leaves a massive historical question. How did American society and American judges conceptually accept this?
Yeah.
How did the people and the politicians rationalize throwing out the old system of strict common law restraints and bringing in this massive new administrative matrix?
It's a huge shift.
To answer that, Custis points the finger at a specific era and a specific philosophical mindset. The progressive reordering.
Yes, the historical analysis here is vital. Custis argues that the progressive movement in the late 19th and early 20th centuries realized that attacking the Constitution directly would be incredibly unpopular. Americans revered the Constitution.
Yeah, of course.
So they didn't try to rewrite the text. Instead, they sought to change the underlying theory of what government is fundamentally supposed to do. They changed the constitutional anthropology.
Let's contrast those two different views of government.
Yeah.
The founders had a very specific anthropology. They viewed human nature as inherently flawed and prone to abusing power. So they saw government as a dangerous beast.
Right.
It was a necessary evil to keep order, but it needed to be kept in very tight, heavy chains. Restraint of power was the primary goal of the Constitution.
Yeah.
How did the progressives view the government?
Well, the progressives looked at the turn of the 20th century, the rise of massive industrialization, the explosion of urban populations, the interconnected national economy, and they saw a society that was becoming incredibly complex.
Mm-hmm.
They believed this complex new world required scientific administration, expert coordination, and rational management. They did not view government as a dangerous beast to be chained. They viewed it as a highly educated manager, an active instrument of social organization that was needed to solve complex problems.
And this difference in worldview leads to how they each viewed necessity. This is one of the most striking parts of the article. Custis points out a brilliant total inversion regarding how we handle a crisis.
Yeah.
To the founders, if there was a national crisis or some complex economic necessity, that was exactly the moment when the government was most likely to panic and overreach. So when things get complex or dangerous, the founders believe the constitutional restraints must be pulled tighter.
That is the classical constitutional view. Necessity does not enlarge authority. It intensifies the need to justify it. Necessity is the traditional excuse of tyrants.
Wow, yeah.
But the progressive model inverted that completely. They argued that because modern society is so complex and because there's so much economic and social necessity, the old constitutional restraints must be loosened for the sake of efficiency and public welfare. Necessity became the ultimate, universally accepted excuse for bypassing fixed constitutional jurisdiction.
So the reformers of that era called this progress. They were progressing toward a scientifically managed society. But Custis asks a really pointed question. What were we actually progressing towards structurally?
Mm.
If we were loosening restraints, bypassing courts, and letting unelected experts manage society based on whatever they claim is a necessity, what is that system in historical terms?
Custis delivers a profound historical gut punch here. The argument is that structurally, we weren't progressing at all. We were regressing. We were regressing back to a concept called prerogative.
Prerogative.
Yeah.
That is a word associated with kings and absolute monarchs.
Exactly. Prerogative is the ancient royal claim that the sovereign, the king, can bypass the fixed written law for the good of the realm or because of some public necessity.
Right.
The entire American constitutional order, born out of the Revolution, was designed specifically to kill the concept of prerogative power. The founders believed no one is above law, no matter how necessary they think their actions are. But Custis argues the administrative state quietly brought prerogative back. We just replaced the king's jeweled crown with a bureaucrat's clipboard. The aesthetic form changed. It's now invisible committees and regulatory agencies instead of a monarch issuing royal decrees. But the governing principle is absolutely identical. Discretionary power expanding wherever the law previously had fixed boundaries.
So to finalize this quiet takeover, to make this return to prerogative seem normal and acceptable to the modern citizen, the administrative state had to rewrite the very vocabulary of American governance. This brings us to a section of Custis' article detailing the linguistic downgrade.
Yeah, this is key.
The author argues that familiar words slowly lost their constitutional meaning. I want to spend some real time on these because this is how the illusion is maintained today. Let's look at the first major shift, the shift from law to policy.
This is a profound shift in how we are governed. Under the founding constitutional model, a law is a rule fixed in advance. It is public, it is equal in application, and crucially, it is binding on both the ruler and the ruled. It restrains power because it clearly defines the boundary before any action is taken.
Right.
Policy, on the other hand, is entirely different. Policy is contingent, it is adaptive, and it is inherently managerial. Policy is designed to expand bureaucratic discretion to achieve a specific goal.
Give me an example of the difference.
A law says the speed limit is 65 miles per hour. It is fixed. If you drive 66, you break the law. If the cop drives 66 without his sirens on, he breaks the law. A policy says the agency shall ensure the efficient and safe flow of traffic.
Oh, I see.
Under that policy, the agency can change the speed limit every day. They can say blue cars have to drive slower. They can close the road entirely. A government of laws subordinates administration to the fixed rule. A government of policy subordinates the rule to the needs of the administration. When policy replaces law, power is no longer restrained. It is merely guided by whatever the experts think is best today.
That perfectly tees up the next shift.
Hmm.
From judgment to expertise.
Judgment, in the strict constitutional sense, is the disciplined application of fixed law. A judge exercising judgment asks a very specific, limited question. If the state has the lawful delegated authority to take this action against this citizen.
Right.
Expertise, on the other hand, derives its legitimacy from asserted technical competence. It doesn't ask if the government has the authority. It asks how power can act most effectively to solve the problem, simply assuming the authority is already there.
So it bypasses the constitutional question entirely.
Completely. When a system replaces constitutional judgment with administrative expertise, it stops asking if the government is legally allowed to do something. Instead, the courts and the legislature just defer to the specialists, the scientists, the economists, the urban planners, who claim they know the most efficient way to manage the issue. It elevates technical knowledge above constitutional restraint.
The third shift Custis identifies is one I found to be the most dangerous conceptually. The shift from rights to interests.
It is devastating conceptual conversion, and it happens in courtrooms every single day now. Under the original framework, a right is a categorical limit. It is an immovable object. It is a brick wall that the government simply cannot cross without exceptional, strictly proven lawful justification.
Mm-hmm.
But an interest is entirely comparative. It is just one variable on a sliding scale.
Explain how that plays out when a citizen challenges the government.
Let's say you claim the government is violating your right to free speech. If the court views speech as a fundamental right, the government almost automatically loses unless they can prove an incredibly strict necessity.
Right.
But under modern jurisprudence, courts often engage in what they call balancing tests. They take your right to free speech and they downgrade it into an interest. And then they weigh your interest in speaking against the government's interest in maintaining public order or administrative efficiency.
And because the government always claims its interest is the safety and welfare of the entire public, the individual's interest almost always looks tiny by comparison.
Exactly. Rights constrain the government categorically. Interests force the citizen to submit to administrative balancing, where the state usually holds the heavier weights.
And the final linguistic shift Custis explores, from accountability to immunity.
We touched on this earlier with Ex parte Young. Historically, holding a public office meant holding a strict fiduciary duty. You were a trustee. If you misused your delegated power and violated a citizen's rights, you faced personal legal consequences. Accountability was internal to the nature of the office.
Right.
But today, the concept of office increasingly carries layers of legal insulation. We have sovereign immunity, qualified immunity, absolute immunity.
The institutions protect themselves.
Precisely. The modern system treats immunity as a necessary condition for administrative function. They argue that bureaucrats can't do their jobs if they are constantly afraid of being sued. But Custis points out that this completely severs the link between exercising state power and bearing the consequence for the abuse of that power. It creates a class of managers who are legally shielded from the damage their errors cause to the citizens they govern.
So putting all of this together, the binary anchor, the alchemy of rights into privileges, the inversion of due process, the circularity of precedent, and the linguistic downgrade of our legal vocabulary, what is Custis's ultimate conclusion? We are left with the illusion of the Republic.
Yes, Custis concludes that the Republican form survives in name, but an administrative managerial form operates in actual practice. We still have the comforting ceremonies, we have the flags, the elections, the inauguration speeches. We have buildings clearly labeled as the three branches of government.
Yeah, the shell is there.
But the functional operative restraints, enumerated power, strictly separated powers, fixed jurisdiction, independent jury trials, and rights that exist antecedent to the state, those have all been fundamentally displaced by a managerial counterconstitution. The symbols of the old house endure, but the structural foundation beneath them has been completely rebuilt.
Let's step back and recap this incredible and, frankly, somewhat unsettling journey we've been on. We started by looking at a house where the plumbing and foundation had been secretly replaced overnight.
Right.
We've seen, through the detailed architectural lens of Publius Custis, how the administrative state didn't conquer the Constitution by force.
Mm.
There was no military coup. Instead, it hollowed the original structure out from the inside.
Yeah.
It flipped the burden of proof so that citizens are effectively presumed non-compliant until they prove their innocence. It converted inherent human rights into regulated state-granted permissions. It combined the legislative, executive, and judicial powers into massive self-contained bureaucratic agencies, and it substituted fluid, expert policy for fixed constitutional law.
And it managed to do all of this over a century while continually using the familiar language of the original constitutional system to justify its own expansion, creating a self-ratifying loop of unassailable power.
So why does all of this deeply theoretical legal analysis matter to you, the person listening right now? Why should you care about 19th century state constitutions or the definition of an Article III court? Because every single time you are audited by a tax agency and have to spend your own money to prove you didn't make a mistake,
mm-hmm.
every time you have to beg a local zoning board for a permit to build a shed on land you supposedly own, or apply for a license to run a basic business out of your home, you are experiencing this rival operational constitution firsthand.
Absolutely.
You're interacting with the state, not as a sovereign principal instructing a hired agent, but as a managed subject, asking a bureaucratic manager for permission to act. You are living inside the renovated house.
And that reality leads to a final, rather chilling implication built directly on Custis's analysis. The author leaves us with a stark warning about the future. We know from history that a constitution can survive the people who wrote it in mere text. The words can remain printed on parchment under glass forever.
Right.
But if an entire generation of citizens is raised exclusively inside this modern administrative matrix, a matrix where they are taught from birth that freedom is not an inherent right, but just a temporary revocable policy objective granted by experts, what happens when the institutional memory of what a true right actually is completely dies out?
Wow.
Does the original Constitution even exist in any meaningful reality if there is absolutely no one left alive who knows how to invoke its original grammar?
That is a profoundly heavy question to leave hanging in the air. The next time you find yourself filling out a government form, the next time you have to navigate an administrative portal to ask for permission to live your life, look closely at the paperwork. Look past the familiar paint on the walls and try to see the plumbing running behind them. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the structure around you.